Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and welcome to 2020. This is our first interview of the year. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother, Caroline Kilburn, will not be joining us today, but check back next week for another interview with Caroline by my side. Well, actually, we're on other opposite ends of a phone line, usually, but close enough. Our guest today on Writers' Voices has some Iowa ties. He is a graduate of the University of Iowa. Michael Zapata is the founding editor of Make, a literary magazine. He is the recipient of an Illinois Art Council Award for Fiction, the City of Chicago D-Case Individual Artist Program Award, and a Pushcart nomination. As an educator, he taught literature and writing in high schools servicing dropout students. As I mentioned, he's a graduate of the University of Iowa and has lived in New Orleans, Italy, and Ecuador. He currently lives in Chicago with his family, and we're talking with Michael today about his debut novel, The Lost Book of Adana Moreau, and I'm not sure that I pronounced that correctly, but we'll find out soon. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Michael.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for inviting me. And yes, that was an absolute correct way to say Adana Moreau.
All right. So this is it doesn't really fit into a genre. It's called literary fiction. That's what it says on the cover. But it's got elements of science fiction and elements of almost historical fiction and surrealism almost.
Yeah. And thank you for saying that. I like the fact that it doesn't fit in and that it's pulling from this sort of sometimes recursive and diverse genre or, you know, literary traditions. I found in the process of writing it that just sort of instinctively happened. And then I had to reflect upon it later and I asked myself, why was that happening in the condition as far as when I was writing it? And the answer was pretty, I think, straightforward for myself, is that I'm mixed. My father is a Latin American immigrant from Ecuador, and my mother is, her family history is Lithuanian Jewish. And so I spent a lot of my youth listening to voices of desplazados, which are displaced peoples, and from two seemingly very different worlds. So the concept of parallel worlds, the concept of digging into sort of these diverse histories that entail not only immigration, but sort of entail what it's like when two worlds sort of collide in a place like Chicago, made a lot of sense for me. So I didn't even realize I was writing what some people have said, like multi-genre or genre bending or whatever that might be, until I was done. I wanted to get sort of the voice of my life and what I knew through, you know, like I said, through voices of desplazados and through this great oral tradition from, you know, Lithuanian Ashkenazi Jewish people who came to America in the early 20th century, and then also the more recent Latin American immigration that was happening in the 1970s to places like New York, Miami, Chicago. And so those worlds collided for me, starting at birth, so it made sense.
In your DNA.
So in my DNA. So it made sense after the writing was done that's what had happened in the process of it.
Actually, there's a great line about that right near the end about the DNA.
You know, and like you had mentioned, I went to University of Iowa as an undergraduate and did participate in the undergraduate writer's workshop. And I found that what was missing around those tables was found in evolutionary biology. So I studied evolutionary biology as well. And so this concept of this deep history and DNA and what we carry with us, those histories that are unknown, and then what we're more prevalently aware about in our own sort of personal histories, I've always sort of liked thinking about those ideas. And I also think in some ways, too, historical fiction per se and science fiction share these otherworldly qualities. It's, you know, history sort of reaches us towards the present, like almost as if it's another world, even though we're impacted by those previous worlds. And again, science fiction does the same, but going the other way. You know, we're imagining and impacted by what we imagine the future to be. So I found them in the present sort of a reconciliation, and I'm interested in sort of always exploring those ideas of how the past and the future collide in the present.
Wow. Okay. This is just amazing. Just really great. We're covering so much ground, and the book does too. And, you know, when you're talking about, you decided as you were studying writing that evolutionary biology is what was missing from the conversation. And I kind of tell you this story about my 10-year-old grandson and my 7-year-old granddaughter, who are both very creative. And my grandson he writes stories all the time. He's writing a graphic novel about adventure raptors.
Yes, I love it.
Yeah, and he wants to be a movie director when he grows up, and he's absolutely determined that he's not going to change his mind, that that's what he wants to be. And recently, both of these two children have gotten really, really interested in Pokemon and the Pokemon characters. And I was thinking about what it is, and the thing about it, Pokemon, that they like so much is that the characters evolve. They change, they actually change shape, and they have different paths of evolution that they can take. Mm-hmm. I had no idea that this was part of Pokemon.
It introduces this sort of wonderful, you know, concept, Darwinian concept into game, right? Into the whole big question of what if.
Yeah. And like Eevee is their favorite, and because it has, I don't know, 8 paths of evolution or something like that.
It's wonderful. I love that. You know, growing up as a child, I think one of the biggest things that attracted me to reading science fiction and literary fiction together is this that question of what if, which I think is a question that is built into the fabric of like human curiosity. It's built into sort of this cultural tradition that's been in humanity for a million years, but it's also built into our genetics, right? The whole billions of years of what if and introducing what ifs to a species. And to sort of come around and tie that up, I also think that that's just an extraordinary question, not only for children, but also and scientists, but also for writers. It's a really useful concept, I think, for first-generation writers or immigrants or those writers who throughout history have not had sort of the limelight in sort of the cultural American tradition. Because I think we're often forced, you know, speaking as a first-generation writer, too, we're often forced through exile and material struggle and catastrophe, whether that be historical or personal, to sort of imagine other paths for ourselves. And so I think one of the founding questions or one of the founding sort of infrastructure on which storytelling exists is just that simple question, what if? Mm-hmm. I taught high school dropouts for 10 years, and we always tried to trace back sort of those original narratives. I taught English and film, and we would always come back to what ifs, right? We would always come back to what's sort of the multiverse are you living in day to day with sort of your day to day decisions, and also what sort of historical decisions that others made for you or against you or on your behalf sort of forces you to imagine what paths are possible. It's very like Borges-like as well. And I just think it's such a wonderful thing that children have that instinctively. And then, you know, and then when we're writers many, many years later, we have to like find that again. Like those very sort of like multiverse questions, like what if, what's possible given the historical conditions of my life.
Now, The Lost Book of Adana Moreau, the kind of the basic narrative premise is, why don't you tell it? I'm sure you can describe it better than I could.
Yeah. So essentially it's about a Dominican refugee exile, you know, in the early 20th century, you know, the United States, as it is prone to, with Latin America, invaded the Dominican Republic in the early 20th century, so it did create a number of exiles who ended up in the United States, many who ended up in New Orleans. And so we have this Dominican refugee who marries a pirate, a smuggler, and she writes this new Latin American-based novel about parallel worlds and sort of her place in it. And local acclaim happens, and she passes away shortly after writing a second manuscript, a sequel to the first one. And so what essentially happens is this literary mystery in which, in the year 2004, an Israeli, also an Israeli exile, finds the lost manuscript in his grandfather's things after his grandfather passes away. And so he has to do, you know, some detective work and kind of follow the path not only of how his grandfather had the lost manuscript, but also that path takes him through the Great Depression. It takes him through the Russian Revolution. It takes him through Pinochet's Chile. And so all these, like, events sort of coalesce in the manuscript and the people who orbit around it. And it finds its sort of catharsis. It finds its end in post-Katrina New Orleans.
Yeah, so there's a lot of kind of tragic times that you're visiting in this book. What do you think draws you to that?
Oh, such a good question. What draws me to disaster? such a good question. You know, I think when you look at sort of disaster as the infrastructure in which people's lives move around in, or disaster as sort of this rupture in time and space. I think when we have these disasters in history, whether it's something like, you know, the Jewish Pale settlement of Russia, which was just ongoing, ongoing disaster. When you have World War I, when you have Russian revolutions, you have these disasters and whatever they might be in history, I think what happens is this sort of historical rupture in time and space. You know, I always think of Asimov describing a black hole, and I remember reading him as a kid thinking, when he describes a black hole, I just kept thinking about, or where did my family come from? You know, what stories are sort of forever lost when you have these ruptures in time and space? And so I think I've always naturally been drawn, if not to like overt historical disasters, disasters that sort of have an impact on memory, maybe, or have an impact on what could have been, as we were talking about previously with what if. And it's always those big historical questions, what is sort of the personal agency when you have sort of these great, almost fate-like feeling disasters in history and how we're supposed to navigate those. It very much fits into the traditions, I think, of, again, going back to my family, the ongoing disaster, pogroms and the Pale Settlement in Russia and Eastern Europe and sort of what was lost then, but also sort of this Colombian exchange that happened when the Spanish and the Portuguese showed up in Latin America and what was reconciled, what was lost, and sort of that global collision between indigenous people in Latin America and also Spain. So I think I've always been drawn to that just by nature of just trying to just rediscover where my family came from. And then you do find there's a lot of like personal disasters in between those. And so I think it's always a balance between the historical and the personal, if that makes sense.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Jewish stories, the Jewish tales, and kind of one of the things that was the hardest to read was the story of Benjamin's father, so Saul's grandfather's father, who was also Saul, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, had not told this story all his life until he tells it to these two young boys. And I've been, you know, the last interview we did was with a soldier who had PTSD and moral, what he called, or what has been called moral injury. And a lot of times, so I've been thinking a lot about that and about how these stories of real violence and horrible things often get aren't told. They aren't told by the people that experience them. They get repressed. And we've also done a number of interviews on books by or about Holocaust survivors, and many times they didn't talk about it for years and years and years and years, and then finally started to talk about it near the end of their lives. Were there stories in your family that were as tragic as that story?
Yeah, you know, there is, you know, when you're digging and researching sort of family history, there's always, you know, I think we can all find sort of those tragedies. But as far as overt ones that are sort of happening to us because of disaster, I found, you know, I'm very fortunate. My two grandfathers who I'm very close to are still alive. In fact, my grandfather in Ecuador is 100.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he is, you know, he is sort of this rich tradition. He was a farmer, and he was a farmer, and always in his mind to this day, because we talk about it all the time, he was a labor activist. And so he did a lot of organizing around people who were essentially, you know, the oppression that was coming from the state or from companies in Ecuador from the 1950s all the way through the 80s. He did a lot of labor organizing around that. So he has always shared with me that fight, and that fight built around people's personal tragedies and disasters, but one that sort of influenced the way he thought about humanity, influenced the way he thought about solidarity. Because I think from disaster and sort of thinking about what if we have some choices to make, and for my grandfather in Ecuador, it was always about forming solidarity around particular issues that caused the disasters and fighting them. And so he's always shared with me those family narratives. He's always shared with me, you know, his deeply held beliefs in fighting for union rights and for solidarity. And these very tough fights when many people in the village that he lived in were poor. So organizing around those issues became for him a fight. My grandfather in Chicago, who's still alive, who's 96, did not start sharing with me those tragedies until he was much, much older, probably not until like 5 or 6 years ago. And he did fight in World War II. And so he has always, he started sharing with me sort of the deeply sort of Chicago sarcastic existentialism of those tragedies, where, you know, he's placing it, and, you know, he's a socialist, he's a humanist of sort of the old Chicago world, and I say old Chicago world, but there's an enormous amount of wonderful activism happening around those same things today. But he started sharing those with me a little bit later in life. You know, one of the most straightforward and I think painful things he always said about his Judaism, and he's a secular atheist, but he carries Judaism as his culture, as his history, is that when he was standing in line for food in World War II, there was a fight that almost broke out against him because there were some soldiers who were angry at him for being Jewish, and they had thought that the reason they had been drafted was because of Jews.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So
boy, that's not a story we hear.
No, correct. And you know, when you talk to my grandfather about, quote-unquote, the greatest generation, he always says we were just as terrible as all human generations. He really has this sort of old-world humanism about it. And, you know, through the years, what he has shared with me is our family lineage that he believes that were lost pre-Holocaust in Eastern Europe, in the Pale, and also post. And so he has not become verbal about those things until later in his life. And it was about at that which point that I started asking him more and sitting down with him and really sort of exploring what disaster has meant, not only for our family, but also for the Jewish people as a whole. Going back to that ship ride in the novel, which does the corner, the center of it, excuse me, is definitely a horrific scene. That's not something that I had been told or straightforward, but there were similar things happening in the research that I found. I had gone to the Chicago Historical Museum to really sort of look at the oral tradition of Jews who came to Chicago, and it found some horrific things in the passing, which was curious and interesting to me to think about individuals who had survived through so much, and then it was the passing from Europe to the United States on these ships where oftentimes terrible things could happen, that sort of left like a hole in my head, a huge question as far as, you know, what does that mean for when they come to America? And many of those things were also, I was reading about, was the Jewish individuals who were sent back to Europe or found a home in Latin America, and connecting that today to Latin American voices and those people who are being deported today. I'm always sort of interested in what that passing means for them as individuals, and it's only until later that we sort of explore those stories of passing and can get those voices.
Oh yeah, I mean the
quick, oh yeah,
the horrible things that are happening now to people fleeing, you know, they're fleeing their homes because they are forced to
correct.
Save their lives, and yet worse, just as bad or worse things are happening to them on the way or when they try to cross the border into the United States.
Correct.
It's, yeah, it's.
And so, it absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and we could, and the thing is that some people who might read this part of the story that you wrote and say, oh, that's horrible, how could people act that way, will turn away and not even look at what's happening today.
Correct. And I hope there's a little bit turning towards it. That would be just, you know, one of the greatest things I think a writer could ask for is, like, how do we turn history towards the present? And being Lithuanian Jewish and also being first generation Latino, you know, when you look to the border and you look at camps, I'm speechless. I've been asked a few times to write about it, and I don't know if I can at this point. Although we need to, but it's just one of those experiences where, you know, turning towards history and sort of having this gut reaction of empathy. Namwali Sirpal, who I really adore as a writer and a thinker, she calls it some film and literature an empathy machine. I don't know that when we read these passages or novels or essays, if we just have empathy, it sort of becomes this sort of self-fulfilling cycle. It's what we do afterwards, if that makes sense. I fully believe that writers often have one foot in the literary world and sort of that solitariness of writing, but I'm also very concerned about what we do when we turn towards the present, when we put the book down. Can that empathy be sort of can it be sort of like a force that turns us toward any action for the
yes,
present?
Exactly.
And that's something I don't have an answer for. I'm just concerned and interested in this idea of the empathy machine and how can we turn towards what happened in World War II and have action about it today on the border.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Michael Zapata, author of The Lost Book of Adana Moreau. So, Mike, I know you taught writing for a long time, or literature and writing. Have you been writing your whole life?
Good question. You know, in some form or another, yeah, I taught in Chicago. I taught dropout students for 10 years. Most of the students like me were first-generation Latino and navigating sort of this new world and what was working for them or not working for them in the larger school system. Through teaching, I kind of saw how some of those students turned towards writing. As far as my own life, I always enjoyed writing when I was young, but it was less about, I think, you know, fabricating a story or writing things down, and more so listening. If that makes sense. My, you know, growing up in Chicago and then outside of Chicago as well later, you know, my father is just a natural storyteller, and we often would spend a lot of our weekends in Chicago, just at barbecues and parties with other recent immigrants from Brazil and Cuba and Mexico for sure, and Colombia. And so what became this act of listening, just these wonderful stories, whether it was someone complaining about their cousin in Mexico City who was, you know, bothering them, just like our cousins can do, or whether it was sort of these more deeper stories about passing. But I found that when I was a child, it was a great joy to listen to those stories, and that sort of like also transcended into growing up with a lot of other first generation Americans. I grew up with Assyrians, friends from India, from Iraq, from Latin America, and there was a lot. I think growing up in the 80s, there was a lot of, you know, immigration in Chicago, where as a child I would, you know, listen to these stories, and it wasn't impactful until later in life, for me, college and then post-college, in which those sort of oral traditions made sense to me as how stories work. In my 20s, you know, I rarely wrote prose and was drawn immediately to the stage. So I wrote for quite some time for the stage, one act plays. I was in a comedy troupe for some time. I was really drawn to monologues, which makes sense, given sort of the oral tradition and narrative history of how I grew up, and just long discursive monologues that under the right actor or actress just can be phenomenal on stage. And so it wasn't until I was 29 or 30 that I decided to turn more seriously towards prose and fiction on the page.
Are you an actor also?
Absolutely not. I got conned into doing one play, and just like any horror story, I forgot all my lines and had to do this like horrible improv. So never again did I go on stage. I like sitting in the audience and you know, listening to the play and watching it
Yeah,
after the work was done.
you never get over those experiences, do
No. But I think to this day, and hopefully future, I think writing for the stage definitely has impacted the way I view prose. And I always come back to Studs Terkel in Chicago, who's always a personal hero of mine, because the way he would able to approach strangers or friends, and the way he would pull out almost these long, just absolutely wonderful monologues. That people were able to sort of explore their own life. I mean, any of Studs Terkel's collections of his oral tradition for me is like an instant go-to for how to capture story, even though those are real stories told by real people on the street and elsewhere. I think Studs Terkel had this absolutely insightful talent for asking the exact right question at the right time. And so in my mind, growing up and listening to you know, voices of displacement, desplazados, and listening to those immigrants that, you know, I grew up listening to with my parents, makes sense, because Studs Terkel was like sort of the perfect literary hero who would just ask someone like my dad to tell him about being a child in Santa Fe in Ecuador in a small farming village, and then getting like 15 pages of essentially the most wonderful autobiography or memoir that I think exists on page.
Well, in your book, in The Lost Book of Adonna Moreau, there's a couple of times where you're addressing this thing. How do you get people to tell their stories, particularly when it's a tragic story, and particularly to a stranger? You know, how and the story of how Saul's grandfather was able to get a story from a Sicilian. Or an Italian fighter, Italian World War II veteran, because of something that Saul himself, as an 8-year-old, I think, said to him. I thought that was really intriguing.
Thank you. You know, and I think I pulled, you know, looking at how those questions are asked, you know, one thing my grandfather in Chicago always says, you know, about being Jewish is, he always said, I would have been like 7 or 8, so I didn't fully comprehend it, but he always said, you know, we're people that can argue even with God. And since you are, that was like dinner table talk. So it was always like, and what I took that later on as stating is that the gall to ask questions, right? And think about the most prominent or the most prominent or sort of insightful question that you can ask at the given time. I really wanted to pull, and I'm so glad that you took those scenes as related to this, because I really wanted the historian Benjamin's character to sort of reflect sort of that Studs Terkel tradition, and sort of that oral tradition. I also think it's something historians share with writers substantially, is asking the wrong question or asking a question can really block an individual off. I think anyone, you know, as a thousand times I'm sure you know, as an interviewer, when you're asking just the right question at the right time, it could just unfold into this other, almost otherworldly experience where you get to explore issues. It could also do the opposite. It could shut people off. And I do think that given the tradition of, there is this big tradition of immigrants, and definitely I would agree with you, soldiers, especially World War II soldiers, where, you know, there's decades of quiet, or there's decades of sort of untelling where those stories are too present or too painful to tell. And sometimes I think it takes the right person at the right time to ask a question. And I do think because humans have this natural sort of, you know, like we talked about earlier, sort of genetic instinct to tell stories and build stories or as the infrastructure of our lives, I think what we are awarded when those voices are recorded or when they're written down in some form, whether that's through history or whether that's through fiction or poetry, I think can be quite extraordinary. And for some of us, it's the only thing we have at the end of our lives.
Well, in addition to being able to ask the right question at the right time, it's knowing when to stay quiet.
Yeah, the listening.
The listening, yeah.
The listening, absolutely.
And, you know, over the years, people have called me a really good listener, and the thing is, the reason I think is that I already know my story. I'm not that interested in it because I already know it. I'm much more interested in other people's stories.
Absolutely, and I think it's one of the greatest gifts
to offer someone is
that listening, whether it ends up in a literary mode or not. I always think about, there's always these terms of like giving voice to the voiceless or people who are invisible. And sometimes I have conflict with those terms, because when you look at the predominant voice and the predominant mode of storytelling in any history, and in American history, maybe a little particularly, it is not the media's voice. It is not the voice of sort of the 1% that gets echoed into this enormous chamber. But when you sit down at dinner, or when you're on the train, or when you're exchanging comments with coworkers, and I think this is especially true in immigrant communities, you get this narrative of people and people telling their own stories to each other times a billion every day. And I think I always find it interesting when we were sort of trained in the modern age to look at sort of what's in the media or what's published sometimes in books to give us what is the arc of history or voice. And obviously it's very true that people have been left out of that. But I also think that the predominant narrative voice in American history is not recorded in its dinner table and its family talking to each other. I'm always conflicted about those terms, the invisible.
Yeah. Plus it's also sort of denying the power that those people have, their own sort of agency. It's denying their own agency.
And you know, when I was young, I worked, my father's he was a jewelry caster in Jewelers Row in Chicago, which through just happy accidental circumstances in Chicago during that time, and even today, the predominant workers in Jewelers Row are Jewish and Latin American immigrants. I found myself at home as a kid. But essentially, one of my jobs when working with my dad is I would deliver, do pickup jobs like, you know, gold or casting jobs or diamonds or. So I would go on my skateboard and I'd go across the street on Wabash and I'd go in these big maze-like buildings. And so I would exchange, you know, I would pick a job up or hand it off. But essentially, what was sort of extraordinary is that sort of becomes a warren, a network of immigrants. And so the network by which that business survived and prospered was, to my young mind, storytelling. Because I would hand in a job, and it only takes a minute, but, you know, oh, you know, you're so-and-so's son or you're related to so-and-so. You end up talking for 5, 10, 20 minutes, sometimes longer, and you get those stories. I'll always remember, in a form of it is in the novel, but I always remember there was a Guatemalan immigrant who my dad often exchanged. He was a polisher and often exchanged work with. And I don't know if he thought I was, you know, had a lot of time or if he just took a liking to me. But he told me how he had served in prison for helping farmers. He told me sort of this long story. And he didn't tell it in a way that was catastrophic to his own life, but almost in a way where he was proud to have not served in a horrific prison, but to have fought. And he pulled out some sheets of paper, you know, almost very similar to what's in the novel, and he had shown me drawings that he had done of the prison. And he had always said, I think that one day I'll find someone who could find some use for these. It wasn't until years, years later that I understood that could be a journalist or a historian or a writer.
Oh.
But again, he's telling me this story that I fundamentally and fully take, you know, back to my father. And this was one of the greatest joys of my childhood and one of the greatest points of conflict of my childhood in the sense of, like, being very young and listening to very beautiful and sometimes horrific stories of people coming to the United States. And so this whole warren and network through which all immigrant communities work is the voice. So I'm naturally, like I said, suspicious of voiceless, because the methods by which immigrant communities often survive is through narratives that we tell each other. And it's only until, you know, it's only until someone far removed says we're giving voice to the voiceless that I'm like, you know, immigrant communities have been fighting and telling stories for centuries without you.
That's a very good point. And it's obviously when people do that, it's well-intentioned.
Oh, for sure.
But,
for sure.
Yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Michael Zapata, author of The Lost Book of Adonna Moreau. Mike, would you read a little bit from the book for us?
Absolutely. I'll read from the beginning. His father was a pirate. He had black skin and was a pirate. Regardless of his occupation, or maybe because of it, he was charming and warm-hearted, and loved listening to most anybody who had a story to tell. His mother was a servant to an old Spanish sugar plantation family just out of San Pedro de Marqui. It was said she had Diano blood in her veins and never lied. She had long coffee-colored hair, and all she had known her entire life was the plantation house where she worked with her mother, the Seas of the Antilles, and her parents. On May 16, 1916, the American Marines landed on the island, and her mother and father were killed in the ensuing guerrilla war waged by the peasant caballeros against the Marines, who, according to her father, were nothing more than tigueritos hired by greedy American businessmen who wanted to force them off their land to expand the sugar plantation. That night before her parents' death, she had been half asleep watching an ashy-faced owl perched outside her bedroom window when she heard her parents in the kitchen. She got out of bed. It was nearly midnight. "We should leave now," her mother said. Her father put his finger to his lips, and her mother nodded. "In the morning," her father whispered. Her mother and father stood in the kitchen and held each other, and she noticed that there was blood on her father's pants. She understood then that her father and mother were caballeros. When her mother spotted her over her father's shoulder, she smiled and went to her. Her mother stroked her long coffee-colored hair, just as she had done when she was a child, and told her that the world was the same as it ever was, and not to worry. First thing in the morning, the American Marines came to their home. They dragged her parents outside, bound their hands, and made them kneel in the sand. She heard the shots while hiding under their little village house, where there were small pools of water and dirt and sand and dirty ashen seashells. Once in a century, her father had told her, the sea flooded the land, and for a time, neither existed. 2 days later, her family's employers decided to leave for New York City or back to Madrid. She couldn't remember, but the important thing is that they fled to a city that wealthy people have been fleeing to for centuries. The last thing they told her before speeding off in a taxi was that the Antilles were brutal, and she was one of the last of a brutal race. She thought of her mother, who had worked for the Spanish plant family for nearly 30 years. She was 16. She didn't want to go home, so she lived alone in the plantation house for 2 months, wandering from room to room, eating what was left in the kitchen, cleaning as she had done before, and sleeping for days at a time on a bed that had once belonged to a queen from the House of Bourbon. One afternoon, she packed her clothes and left the plantation house. She headed west towards Santo Domingo, sometimes walking for long stretches at a time along the coast, which was dotted with estates and villages without names, or rather names she had never known, sometimes riding in the back of a cart driven by a sugar worker, who understood without saying so that she was the daughter of murdered caballeros. For 5 weeks, she wandered the streets of Santo Domingo, which were like the streets of a labyrinth, and ate fish and bread scraps at the market. At night, she slept on park benches and dreamed of future civilizations and an endless seabed full of strange, luminescent creatures. At the end of 5 weeks, she met an American in the market who said he was trading with the caballeros and the American Marines. She didn't know why, but she told him the story of how the American Marines had killed her parents. He listened without saying a word. When she was done, he said that he was really a pirate. He said that he gave the caballeros a deep discount and sold shoddy equipment to the American Marines at high prices. He was making money hand over fist. He apologized for talking so much, and then he said she was beautiful. He said he had never seen a more beautiful woman in the Caribbean than her. She told him that his Spanish was good if a little outdated. He said that he also spoke French and some Arabic. The pirate studied her face for a moment and then said he could get her on a ship that would take her to New Orleans. She shook her head. Why not? Asked the pirate. Americans are greedy tigueritos, she said. They're mierda. And me? I don't know yet. Maybe you're mierda. Maybe you're not mierda. Still, she thought about her prospects on that occupied island and decided to leave for Santo Domingo. On the ship voyage, she met a boy who looked out of place. He had deep, sky-black eyes. When she asked the boy where he was from, he said he was from nowhere. So you're an orphan, she said. An orphan, he said and smiled politely. Like me, she said. Like everybody, she thought. Orphans are all the world really has left. 4 days, she lived on the deck of a ship and slept near the orphan boy. She listened as he talked about war and mechanical soldiers and an eternal library that he would one day discover and never leave. He's mad, thought the servant girl. He spoke Spanish well enough, but sometimes he sang in a language that she didn't understand. The songs were like a melismatic trance. One morning, in the middle of a song, he stopped singing and told her that the ship was entering the eye of the Gulf of Mexico. How do you know where the eye is? She asked the boy, teasing him. Just look, he said and shrugged. The sea was deep and blue and alien and as vast as the sky. She imagined that in the distant future, the end of the world would have its origins there, and for some unknown reason, this put her at ease. When the ship arrived in New Orleans, the pirate was waiting for her. A few days later, he asked for her hand in marriage, and she said yes. On April 7th, 1920, Maxwell Moreau was born in a one-room apartment near the Barrack Street Wharf. His mother labored for 17 hours, and during painful bursts of activity, she squeezed her eyes shut and tried to focus on the smells of coffee and bananas and boiled crawfish and the blows and whistles of faraway ocean liners. This was something she thought that all mothers giving birth in New Orleans probably did. When Maxwell Morrell finally came out, the pirate knew that his son would not be a pirate like him. Spending his life on the surface of the sea, a loud and violent sea that swelled with creatures and myths that drove men to early deaths or worse, to an asylum. He swore to it and told his wife that their son had ochre eyes, which were the pigment of earth. The baby, Maxwell Morrell, cried and cried, and his mother held him to her breast and whispered Sonamlu, which was something her husband had taught her to say in French, and which meant sound and light, and was everything the earth wasn't. The Dominicana and the pirates soon bought a home Melpomene Avenue. Occasionally, the pirate worked for a wealthy Creole smuggler, often for long periods of time at sea or by river, and then by marsh in order to help him hide jugs of Cuban rum in the trunks of cypress trees, or guard him as he tried to strike deals with his lenos, laughing, or rather pretending to laugh, which was a type of threat, at least according to the pirate who listened to most anybody with a story to tell, especially an inscrutable isleno. He might as well have pistols for ears and a shotgun for a tongue. He might as well start a gang war, the pirate once told his wife. But he still went and worked for the wealthy Creole smuggler, and she still saw him off and waved as he boarded a motorboat. Sometimes when the wealthy Creole smuggler turned his back to the pirate, he saluted him in mockery of the United States Navy. Then more often than not, the Dominicana stood and chatted with the wealthy Creole smuggler's wife in the lilting heat and saunter of the Louisiana sun, and watched the trill of fishing boats and egrets drift over the Mississippi River as if they were lost in the creation of things. At three, Maxwell Moreau began to wander. He liked sound and light, and he followed it everywhere, like how the ancient Hebrews followed celestial clues and iconographic fever dreams in the desert. One day, a hornet entered the house on Melpomene Avenue and stung Maxwell. He didn't cry, in fact. When the hornet flew out the back door and into a garden of sunflowers, Maxwell followed it. The hornet flew into another yard and then another before landing on a tree. A dog with a half-black muzzle was chained up to the tree, and when it saw Maxwell, it began to bark. Maxwell thought that the dog was even more interesting than the hornet. He walked over to the dog but stopped just short of the length of the chain. The dog barked and barked, and Maxwell smiled and smiled. He teased the dog, and because Maxwell was canny like Sisyphus, he eventually figured out how to untie the dog without the dog biting him. The dog disappeared for some time, and Maxwell waited just before dusk. The dog returned and laid down near the tree. Then Maxwell laid down near the dog with his body pressed against the earth, a pulsating earth with heartbeats, which were the dog's heartbeats, and tremors, which were the tremors of the city, and murmurs, which were subterranean rivers slipping into the lower Mississippi. He then slept in complete peace, and this is how his mother found him.
And that was Michael Zapata reading from The Lost Book of Adonna Moreau. Now, this book is coming out February 4th, I believe?
Correct, yes.
Great.
February 4th.
And it's published by Hanover Square Press, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. And is it also going to be available in an Audible book format?
Yes. I'm very excited about the audiobook as well.
Yeah. So who's reading it?
Coral Benna. So she had read for the Dominicana. She is just an absolutely amazing actress, and I was very excited when she agreed to do that.
Oh, cool. When you started writing this, did you start with an idea of the overall plot, or did you start with a character?
You know, I started one of the few things to remain. These 8 years later is that first sentence. His father was a pirate. I have no idea. I had spent so many years going back and forth, traveling from Chicago to New Orleans, and had spent some time there. I don't think I had an overreaching infrastructure or thought of it. I just started with that sentence and kind of went sentence by sentence. As it grew, and sort of this idea of this lost manuscript, one of the more interesting things to happen was that my grandfather in Ecuador had mentioned to me that my great-grandfather, who was a political exile, was also a secret poet, and that he had his own lost manuscript.
Wow.
However you pronounce that term, apologies, but it became sort of this accidental process that I was looking for my great-grandfather's sort of lost journal of poetry, and how much one impacted the other, I have no idea, but they surely did.
And did you find your great-grandfather's lost manuscript?
I did, recently.
Wow.
Yes.
That's exciting.
So when the novel was finished and when there were advanced copies, my father and mother went to Ecuador, Santa Fe, to celebrate my grandfather's 100th birthday. And this was this past August. I unfortunately couldn't go. I was waiting for the birth of my second son, who was born just about 2.5 weeks later. So didn't want to leave family
right,
in waiting
right.
And show. So But what ended up happening is after years and years of, you know, every time I would visit and go to Ecuador and I would look through my grandfather's things, I would look through different buildings in this farming village. I looked at archives in Quito. I would try to find historians in Ecuador who were working on that period of time that my great-grandfather would have founded the town. And so one of the strangest things was the, you know, my parents had given my grandfather, who, you know, doesn't speak English, doesn't read in English, but had given him the advanced copy. And I don't know if it had this overwhelming effect on him or a memory, but the following day, him and my uncle found the lost manuscript buried in sort of an abandoned farming room that's, you know, across an alley from where my grandfather lives. And it was sort of buried in all of my grandfather's newspapers about all the labor activism that he'd done and sort of the labor wins and losses and fights. And it was just buried in there, apropos, I guess, historically.
Wow.
And it is 480-some pages of my great-grandfather's journals, a substantial amount, which is his poetry.
Wow.
So my mother and father then spent some time at a copy, you know, a copy machine in a provincial city nearby, just copying page after page. And so they brought home in August with them the copy of the journal, which I am currently painstakingly going through.
So is that going to be the basis of your next project?
Oh, what an endeavor to do two books on two lost manuscripts. I'll be lost in a Borges like labyrinth, I think, if I do that. I am sort of going through this joyfully as a point of discovery, but it's so wonderful to have this voice in my head of this individual who I heard stories about my entire life. As a political exile who founded Santa Fe, a farming village that my father grew up in. So it's like this whole other world and this whole other voice that I have absolutely no idea how to contend with right now, but I'm glad I can.
So you started writing The Lost Book of Adonna Moreau, and you said it just sort of came sentence by sentence. Characters must have just shown up for you?
Yeah. You know, I always thought of, I think I went back to how I wrote for the stage, and you just have to have someone show up, right? I think that's a good way to put it. The audience doesn't know backstory, and it's sort of implicit in every line of dialogue. I didn't have this overreaching plan. That said, it took 8 to 10 years. So I play around with some planning.
Yeah, that might help. How did you know when you were done?
Say that again, sorry?
How did you know when you were done, when it was complete, when you had, you know, when the story felt complete to you? Was it just a feeling, okay, this is it, or how did you know?
Yeah, I think that's such a good question. How do you know when something ends? I was in the process of, the story of publication was, I had finished a very early draft, and I had, you know, without knowing much about the publishing world, I sort of had a dream agent, and I sent it off to him. A few months later, I got probably one of the most wonderful rejection letters that I'll ever receive, but it highlighted the things that he had loved, and it highlighted the things that weren't working. And so that was like a really healthy gut punch. At that time, there was an independent publisher in Chicago who was interested in publishing what was the first draft, and I sort of made the decision to start over. So I had felt finished once. But what it really entailed, I think, as far as the story of it, was that I had not pushed sort of the work as far as I could have. At that time, I was teaching in Chicago, so summers were wonderful to write, but I was involved in activism, so there was a lot going on in which I had not fully committed to the project as much as I thought that it deserved. And so I sort of dug in again, and I was really in the middle of it, really no contact with the publishing world, when the agent's assistant, who was then a full agent, my agent now, Chris Clemens, who is an astronomically amazing editor and believer in this book, wanted to know what was going on with it. And so I had moved forward and worked with him when the book was incomplete when we started working together. And he's one of those wonderful sort of editors that said, let's talk about it for 3 hours, and then you're going to disappear for 6 months and work.
Wow.
So that's kind of what happened. And I wasn't quite, you know, I wasn't quite sure where it would end, but I felt coming to an ending that would or would not tie everything up, it was important for me to walk away with it where there was this voice or language that was finite.
So it's pretty unusual to, like, have an agent as a first-time novelist before the book's even done.
Yeah, and I had no idea how any of this worked. And then when I asked a friend, you know, he had called and I said, it's not finished. I don't feel comfortable sending it. And then I had talked to my wife and a very close friend who said, you should send it in 3 days. So I spent three sleepless days trying to make sense out of what I had, and I just sort of sent it off like that. And I just the enormous process by which I was able to verbally edit with Chris just really left an impact on how I think of myself as a writer, which is I like sort of the verbal reportage. I like to talk about things before I do them, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. It's funny because I think my grandfather, the one in Chicago, is very similar, where you create the narrative out loud first, and then it's always been easier for me to get it down on paper, much to the chagrin of my wife, who I'm like in the middle of watching a movie. I'm like, what do you think about this? Pause the movie for 20 minutes. She's a visual artist and has enormous patience.
So are you working on another novel?
I am. Yeah. I've started sort of, what I did do with the first one too, was I think one of the reasons it did take some time was I'm a fan of research, getting lost in sort of that labyrinth of research. So I'm starting that process again. And this one is about a census taker in the year 2050. And it's told, what I have so far is it's told from the perspective, he's telling his story to an aunt as he's locked up in a Chicago black site. And so again, playing, I think, with these long monologues, playing with ideas of what the future entails as far as demographics, encroaching fascism, the sort of disappearing Amazon. The character's mother is a ecologist in the Amazon, an Ecuadorian ecologist. So it's all very loose at this point, but I always like to think about this idea of sort of monoculture and sort of our sort of global march toward this unfortunate monoculture, which is a biological term, as we lose just an enormous amount of diverse species globally, but also sort of the enforcing culture of sort of the 1% and what they want to form for as a global culture, which doesn't really consider, you know, the billions of the rest of us.
Well, Michael, we're out of time, but what I want to say, it sounds like your second book, very much like The Lost Book of Adana Moreau, deals with some very deep and meaningful themes, but is also just a good read. It's a good story.
Thank you.
Draws you along, plus your use of language and the kind of the historical things that get alluded to, even as well as the ones that you delve into, just make it fascinating to read. But thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. It's just been such a joy to talk.
And we'll see you all next week on Writer's Voices.